Today is Monday, July 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, rising coronavirus cases in 39 U.S. states cast a shadow over Independence Day celebrations. A rocket attack in Iraq targeting the U.S. embassy within the so-called fortified Green Zone. Also ahead, a new documentary on the life of a civil rights icon in the U.S.
I think the lesson, you know, what John Lewis teaches us is progress is a long road and that you must remain constant and committed.
It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump spent the 4th of July weekend at Independence Day celebrations in South Dakota and Washington. He used both events to deliver a strong message on law and order, the platform that his campaign is focusing on ahead of the November election. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara traveled with Trump to South Dakota and brings us this story.
A celebration of America's independence above Mount Rushmore in front of a crowd of thousands, most not wearing masks. President Donald Trump delivered a dark and somber speech presenting a re-election campaign platform focused on law and order to rally his supporters against what he calls the new far-left fascism.
We will expose this dangerous movement, protect our nation's children, end this radical assault, and preserve our beloved American way of life.
Trump's visit to this giant monument of past American presidents came after months of Black Lives Matter protests, and as his administration clamped down on protesters who want to remove statues of figures who supported slavery and white supremacy. He delivered a strong rebuke of what he called the cancel culture against the country's heritage.
This monument will never be desecrated. These heroes will never be defaced. Their legacy will never, ever be destroyed. Their achievements will never be forgotten. And Mount Rushmore will stand forever as an eternal tribute to our forefathers and to our freedom.
Vanessa Beasley teaches presidential rhetoric at Vanderbilt University.
Trying to say to his base audience, hey, if you don't like what's happening with all these monuments, I'm going to go to the biggest and most immovable monument there is, and I'm going to claim it as my own.
In a speech that some have called divisive, Trump portrayed the left as an angry mob that incites chaos and steers the country towards totalitarianism.
We will not be tyrannized, we will not be demeaned, and we will not be intimidated by bad evil people.
The us versus them speech came as Trump trails in political surveys, further behind his Democratic campaign rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. Nationally, in key battleground states, and even in traditionally conservative strongholds like Missouri and Texas. Michael Cornfield teaches politics at George Washington University.
Right now, his campaign is a dumpster fire. And I say that not just because of the polls, but because there are Republicans who are vocally opposed to him.
A National Pew Research poll shows Trump 10 percentage points behind Biden. In 2016, Trump managed to beat Hillary Clinton despite her lead in the polls. Robert Griffin is research director of the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group.
There's still a lot of time between now and the election, and 2020, if anything, has shown itself to be a rather tumultuous year. But at present, the president certainly, I think, has a lot to worry about. And it looks like an uphill climb for him.
As new coronavirus cases surpass 50,000 daily, and despite health officials urging Americans to scale back 4th of July celebrations this year, Trump also held a Salute to America event at the White House. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News.
The United States continues to experience dramatic increases in COVID-19 infection numbers. The U.S. state of Florida saw more than 11,000 new cases on July 4th, a single-day record. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, mayors and cities dealing with crowded hospitals and exploding infection rates are raising the alarm about the lack of concern among the population to curb the spread of the coronavirus.
Pubs in Britain welcomed customers for the first time after months of lockdown due to the coronavirus. But in the U.S., the mayor of Phoenix in the state of Arizona says businesses in her city opened too early.
We had crowded nightclubs handing out free champagne, no masks. Our 20 to 44-year-olds, which is my own demographic, really led the explosion, and we've seen such growth in that area. We're seeing a lot of people go to large family gatherings and infect their family members. We are in a crisis related to testing.
Francis Suarez, the mayor of Miami, Florida, is also dealing with a surge of new COVID-19 cases in his city.
But there's no doubt that the fact that when we reopened, people started socializing as if the virus didn't exist.
The concerns come as the United States celebrated the July 4th Independence Day, which saw long lines of cars waiting to get to beaches in some areas and crowds gathering to watch fireworks in others, including the National Mall in Washington, D.C., where President Trump spoke, downplaying the threat of the coronavirus, which has killed nearly 130,000 Americans.
But now we have tested almost 40 million people. By so doing, we show cases, 99% of which are totally harmless.
The president also addressed the urgency of finding a vaccine.
We are unleashing our nation's scientific brilliance, and we'll likely have a therapeutic and/or vaccine solution long before the end of the year.
But the administrator of the Food and Drug Administration, Stephen Hahn, distance his agency from that commitment.
I can't predict when a vaccine will be available, and I just want to tell you about FDA's role in this. Yes, we are seeing unprecedented speed for the development of a vaccine.
Hahn also emphasized measures that can curb the spread of the coronavirus before a vaccine is available.
This is a very rapidly moving epidemic, a rapidly moving pandemic, and any death, any case is tragic. And we want to do everything we can to prevent that. What I would say to the American people is follow the guidance of the CDC, follow the protocols of the local and state governments, wear a mask if you can't socially distance, or if the local procedure is to wear a mask at all times, socially distant, hand sanitation, and protect the vulnerable. That's how we're going to get out of this.
To date, the United States has recorded about 2.8 million cases of COVID-19 and is currently the country with the highest number of infections and deaths in the world. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News.
At least 50 people have died in protests this week in Ethiopia following the killing of popular singer Hachalu Hundessa, known for his political songs. Hundessa's death has heightened ethnic tensions in Ethiopia as the protests spread to the Oromia region where Hundessa was born. As authorities shut down the internet in parts of the country, analysts weigh in on the implications and what needs to be done to check the violence. Mohamed Youssef reports.
Security remains tight across Ethiopia day after the funeral of revered singer and musician Hachalu Hundessa. His killing this week sparked riots in and around Addis Ababa, leaving at least 80 dead. Muridi Mutiga is a Horn of Africa project director at the International Crisis Group. He says the anger witnessed in the streets of Ethiopia was not only about the killing of the musician, but also the country's underlying historical grievances by different ethnic groups.
This whole transition is characterized by very substantial, complex tensions, and the killing of the young musician was essentially a trigger because of the deep frustration that some of the protesters still feel. This killing served as a spark and a trigger for substantial unrest, as we have witnessed.
Hundessa was gunned down Monday night in Addis Ababa, a week after he appeared on the Oromo Media Network, where he criticized Ethiopia's leadership and spoke against the mass incarceration of Oromo youth. The musician was ethnic Oromo, a group that has a long history of being discriminated against. Since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, ethnic groups demand for political, social and economic inclusion, and in some cases, independence have been growing. When he came to power, Abiy promised his administration will take a different approach to the country's problems. Fiseha Tekle, an Ethiopia researcher for rights group Amnesty International, says security forces continue to use force in dealing with demonstrators.
Our preliminary findings indicate that the security forces were shooting at protesters just because they burned tires or they demolished houses or government buildings. That's the case in Adama, for instance. Well, there are some instances where there were ethnic clashes. We can see that the behavior of the security forces towards protests is not in line with human rights standards because they usually use lethal force against protesters.
Jawar Mohammed, opposition politician Bekele Garba, and 33 others were detained by police in connection with riots over the past week. Abiy has vowed to restore calm in the country. Police say three people have been arrested in connection with Wundesa's killing. They gave no details, but the prime minister said the shooting could be tied to the assassination of the chief of the Ethiopian army last year. Mutega says the country needs to carry on with its reforms.
Ethiopia's transition is very carefully watched. It has been a source of hope for many in Ethiopia and outside the country. It's essential that elites really don't fritter away all that hope. They need to find a way to talk. They need a way to find a way to resolve their differences and bring the transition back on track.
Meanwhile, to limit the spread of the violence, authorities have cut internet and mobile phone service. Officials have also postponed elections that were scheduled for next month until next year. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. President Vladimir Putin said Sunday constitutional amendments approved in a nationwide vote created the conditions for Russia's progressive development for decades to come. One of the changes approved in the week-long vote that ended on July 1st makes it possible for Putin to seek two more terms as president and, if reelected, to stay in power until 2036. And Iran's Revolutionary Guards Navy chief Sunday warned of a, quote, nightmare for Iran's enemies, saying Tehran has established underground, onshore, and offshore missile cities all along the coasts of the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman. A rocket aimed at Baghdad's fortified Green Zone, home of the U.S. Embassy, has struck a residential home and injured a child. AP correspondent Sarah Bassett reports.
The Iraqi military say the latest rocket was launched from Baghdad and landed next to a house close to a local TV station. Iraqi security forces say they also thwarted another attack north of Baghdad, aiming to hit a training base used by U.S.-led coalition forces. A recent spate of rocket attacks have struck close to the U.S. embassy and targeted American troops in Iraqi bases. The uptick in attacks comes shortly before Iraq embarks on strategic talks with the U.S., in which the presence of American forces the country is expected to top the agenda. I am Sarah Bassett.
A Turkish court put 20 Saudi officials on trial in absentia Friday for the gruesome killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The killing sparked international outrage and tarnished the image of Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler. Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, in October of 2018 when he went there seeking papers for his marriage license. Some Western governments, as well as U.S. intelligence officials, said they believed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the killing, an accusation Saudi officials deny. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
Well, this is the opening of the trial of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed in October 2018 when he was visiting the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. 20 Saudi nationals are now standing trial for his murder, including Ahmed al-Asari, who's the deputy head of Saudi intelligence, and Saud al-Qahtani, who was the media advisor to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. These are two very close people to the Crown Prince, and those two men are facing the most serious charges of aggravated murder.
Now, was the trial open to the public?
This is a very much a public trial. There were journalists from around the world, including also diplomats. There was also a UN official, Agnes Callamard, who is the UN rapporteur who carried out a report into Khashoggi's murder, and also Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, who was waiting outside the consulate when Khashoggi was being murdered. So it was very much high profile. The Turkish government are very keen to make this a very much an international event as part of their campaign to keep pressure on Saudi Arabia over the murder of Khashoggi.
And what has the reaction been to today's hearing?
I mean, there have been reactions at the end of the hearing, which has been adjourned until November. Agnes Callamard, the UN rapporteur, said, well, she said there are limitations to this case because none of the defendants are present. She said that this is still an important process in keeping the quest for justice for Khashoggi going forward. And Hatice Cengiz, the fiance of Khashoggi, said that her struggle will continue for justice both inside Turkey and internationally. So there is this determination to keep pressure on Riyadh and keep pressure on the international community to keep its pressure to bring those who were responsible for his murder to justice. Riyadh does counter. It says that they have carried out a prosecution, including five people were sentenced to death for Khashoggi's murder. They say that was part of a rogue operation. They were sentenced in December, but that case has been widely condemned internationally because even the identities of the perpetrators still hasn't been revealed, and it's unclear whether any sentence has actually been carried out.
It's a bit ironic that Turkey is leading the way on finding justice for Khashoggi because Turkey is heavily criticized for its own press freedom record. Is that correct?
While there has been very much broad support for this trial against those alleged to be responsible for Khashoggi's murder and support in many ways for the tough stance UNGRA has taken against Saudi Arabia over the killing, a lot of people have also said there's a lot of hypocrisy here because you have to remember Turkey has one of the worst records for jailing of journalists in the world, although UNGRA insists that none of those journalists are in jail for journalist activities. Be that as it may, there is a great deal of, they feel, hypocrisy here that Turkey is trying to position itself as a defender of a journalist where at the same time many other journalists are being jailed. And in fact, in the same courthouse as this case was carried on, a number of human rights defenders were jailed for what international human rights groups say were absolutely spurious charges, including the founder of Turkey's Amnesty International branch, who was sentenced to over 6 years in jail. So this just underlines what many people see as the hypocrisy of Ankara's stance. Now, Ankara dismisses this, insists that this country is a rule of law, and this is why they are determined to bring Khashoggi's murderers to justice.
VOA's International Edition continues. Millions of Congolese recently celebrated the 60th anniversary of independence from Belgium and the fall of one of the most prominent symbols of the colonization and plunder of their country, King Leopold II. He has been called the Butcher of the Congo, who oversaw a brutal administration over the Congo Free State and was responsible for the deaths of an estimated 10 million Congolese over the span of 23 years. Professor Adam Hochschild is the author of the critically acclaimed book King Leopold's Ghost. In the second part of his interview with Hochschild, VOA's Jackson Vunganyi hears about how Leopold gave up his control over the Congo Free State and asks if it was possibly due to the rubber business not being as lucrative anymore.
No, the rubber remained lucrative, and Leopold owned the territory for 23 years. But then there was growing pressure on him to give it up because there were human rights agitators, principally in England, but also in the United States and in other European countries, who were shocked at the atrocities of this system. And they felt, mistakenly, I think, that it was so brutal because this possession was, this colony was the personal possession of one man, and that if the territory could just be taken out of the king's hands, the system would become much less brutal. I think they had a too simplified way of thinking about things because, as I mentioned, you know, the other European colonies in the region
were already doing the same thing.
Were using the same system.
Right.
But nonetheless, there was greater and greater pressure on Leopold to give up the Congo. So finally, in 1908, he made a deal with the Belgian government where he said, all right, we'll let it become the Belgian Congo, but you have to pay me for it. So in effect, he sold the Congo to Belgium. The payment was to be in installments. It was never fully made because he died the following year. And then a couple of years after that, the First World War began and Belgium was occupied. But the arrogance of this man saying, I'll only give up my colony if you pay me for it.
What? How many times did he visit the Congo?
He never went there because he knew statistics which were not released to the public, which were that basically one out of every three white Europeans who went to the Congo died there of tropical diseases. Because
for his life, that's why he didn't go.
Yeah, especially in the early years, they didn't know how malaria and yellow fever worked. They had no cure for them. And with that high death rate, Leopold, who was something of a germaphobe to begin with, simply did not want to set foot in the Congo. So he never went there.
Okay, so let's fast forward to, I guess, what is happening right now in the world and especially in Belgium. The perception of Leopold among Belgians, how is he understood by the Congolese, and how different is that from how Belgians think about him and his place in history?
Well, I think most Congolese have some sense of what a terrible period this was. And of course, many of these atrocities continued into the time that it was the Belgian Congo, because basically, forced labor was the foundation of the economy in most colonies in Africa south of the Sahara before the Second World War. So forced labor continued, not quite as brutally, because around 1920, the Belgian colonial officials who'd taken over from Leopold realized how high the death rate was. And you can actually find them saying this on paper, saying, unless we change the system somewhat, we're not going to have any labor force left. So it was at that point that they began moderating the forced labor system, introducing medical clinics to keep workers healthy and so forth. But I think most Congolese have some sense of just how brutal this system was. In Belgium, however, here was this quite small country that had this huge colony, the largest colony in sub-Saharan Africa. And, most Belgians for decades like to think of themselves as having gone there to spread Christianity and bring civilization and bring literacy and so forth. And, there were certainly good people like missionaries, priests, teachers, doctors, and so forth who did that kind of work. But overall, I think all colonialism is basically based on trying to extract wealth from the colony and bring it back to the mother country. I think this has begun to change in recent years, in part because there is now something of a population of African descent living in Belgium itself. I don't know what the exact numbers are. It's probably not more than 60 or 70,000. People whose ancestors came there from Congo or from Rwanda. But these folks have been demanding, it's time to take down those statues of Leopold. And I think that combined with the ricochet around the world of the George Floyd video has just had a tremendous effect. Mm. And some of those statues of Leopold have come down.
That was Professor Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book King Leopold's Ghost, speaking with VOA's Jackson Funganyi. A just released new film is taking on more relevance at a time when the United States grapples with its issues of racism and equality. Magnolia Pictures' new documentary, John Lewis, Good Trouble, tells the story of Congressman John Lewis, an American hero and inspirational icon who refused to give up the fight for racial justice, equality, and voting rights, and notably says in the film, That's how you get into good trouble. Joining us to hear more about the man and the making of this documentary is director Don Porter. Thank you so much for being with us. This film couldn't be more relevant to what is currently happening in the U.S.
One of the things I wanted to do with this film was to make sure people understand that John Lewis is a living, breathing, working person, and he is not a postage stamp. He should not become calcified in history. And it was important to me to show how his activism has continued and grown and evolved and changed. And I would like people to think of that. He certainly could have said, I have done enough. I have done enough for all of you. And instead, he did the opposite. He said, how can I do more? How can I make sure that the laws of this country are fair to the people with the least power? And I found that very moving, that this really is his life's work. I think that one of the lessons that John Lewis so beautifully exemplifies for us is that we have different callings at different times of our life.
Clearly, he's so beloved. You could visibly see that every step of the way in this film. Revered, respected, and a sense of humor, a sense of authenticity. I think is valuable to just, he is a civil rights icon and he is also now a politician to some degree, but he's also, as you said, a real person doing things. What does it say about how far we've come and how much John Lewis has done and what we've seen in the past months?
I think the tragic period, visible, continued police violence and other racist acts remind us painfully, heartbreakingly, that we must be vigilant. I think, and I include myself in this, that when President Obama was elected, I felt a sense that there had not only been change, but there had been real change, that his election was also emblematic of our collective evolution. And I do think that that is still the case, but I also think to some extent it meant we weren't seeing what we didn't want to see. It was easier to ignore casual racism and homophobia and sexism. That was a mistake. The lesson John Lewis teaches us is progress is a long road and that you must remain constant and committed.
He seemed to repeat over and over, we do not have time for despair. We need to keep going. It's not time for despair. It's time for action. I mean, that really resonated throughout the film. That is what he wants.
That is exactly what he wants. So I spent the better part of a year interviewing him, going places with him. And there were times when I would say, Mr. Lewis, this thing upset me or that thing upset me. And he was always counseling me about just the thing that you're bringing up. I think to some extent, his message is don't focus on the other folks that, you know, kind of examine your own behavior. And John Lewis is a person who lives his values. And for that reason, he's a very peaceful, optimistic person. You know, sometimes you don't want to meet the people that you admire because you don't want them to ruin it for you.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I do not have that problem with John Lewis because he is such a gentle, peaceful person that it's almost hard to reconcile his fierce, steely spine. And to know that these qualities exist in the same person really, really affected me. I think that he's so peaceful because he's not compromising. He talks about living without fear. That has like freed him, living without fear. And, you know, so one of the things I've been thinking is, you know, we all don't have to march on the bridge. We all don't have to confront the police, but we can think about what we can do. And what if we did live our lives without fear? What if we didn't worry if it would offend somebody, if we called out their racism or their sexism or their homophobia? What if we weren't quiet when those things happened? Perhaps they wouldn't percolate to become this virulent, overpowering force that they seem to be right now. So that's one of the things that I have taken away from my time with him, which has been a very, very important and meaningful experience for my life. He's still protesting, but he's also doing the politics. He's always looking for a way for lasting change.
Thanks so much for being with us. That was Don Porter, director of the brand new Magnolia Pictures documentary, John Lewis, Good Trouble. The Black National Anthem, a popular hymn within the African-American community, was born more than a century ago, but Lift Every Voice and Sing is being revived as a beacon of hope once again. In recent weeks, during countless rallies across the nation from D.C. to Seattle, demonstrators of different races have been reciting the song's lyrics while marching against police brutality of unarmed Black people. Some protests have been peaceful, others have turned violent. But one lasting theme has been people chanting the anthem's long-lasting message of faithfulness, freedom, and equality. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us.